This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today, right on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And thanks everyone for being here today. This is the Sunday morning wake-up call. Today, one of those topics that I've, you know, a little personal interest in as a University of Virginia graduate, and one that sometimes just gets that, especially once you move outside of the university and the grounds area, tends to just be that memorable issue or one that you don't have a lot of information about, even when the topic comes up frequently. We will be talking about the honor code at the university that extends to other universities have similar honor codes. We'll move into honor itself throughout the hour. Our guest today, Nick Hine. He's the chair of University of Virginia Honor Committee. Nick, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
It's especially a beautiful Sunday, and a student getting up early for 11 o'clock show coming in.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to lie, I almost didn't make it, but luckily my alarm woke me up. But there's a reason I was running a couple minutes late.
It's probably, and that's why Sunday I always morning. Send people emails.
Yeah.
Reminder. But we will be, we'll be talking about the university's honor code throughout the hour. We'll be stretching from some of the recent changes that have been made for years, for decades, for more than 100 years into a second century. And finally, there is a change made to the honor code. So, Nick, real quick, what is the honor code for a student?
So, the honor code is, I mean, it's a couple of things. At its most basic level, the honor code is, a pledge that students sign in the classroom on their academic work that says, on my honor as a student, I've neither given nor received aid on this assignment or exam. And so, you know, at its sort of its most basic form, the honor system is a completely student-run disciplinary system. It's a system run by students for students that adjudicates cases of lying, cheating, and stealing. But at sort of a greater level, it's a lot more than that. It's something that is meant to foster a culture of unwavering and unhesitating trust. This thing that we call the community of trust at UVA.
So we're going to go back and forth through this throughout the hour. But so lying, cheating, and stealing, is that only within the university itself, within students, faculty, and other workers for the university?
So the honor code, the sort of formal bounds of the honor code only apply to students. They only apply to students at UVA, and they only apply to students in Charlottesville or Albemarle County, or anywhere where they are representing themselves as a University of Virginia student. So you can imagine that, you know, so you might not be in Charlottesville, but if you're studying abroad or you know, away on, a athletics trip or something, and, you know,
they've had the semester at sea.
Semester at sea, exactly. So you don't necessarily have to be in Virginia for it.
All right, again, we'll be talking about the honor code and honor itself. Our guest, Nick Hine, he's the chair for UVA's honor committee. So a little bit of history for us, please. The honor code, why it began.
Yeah, of course. So the honor code was inaugurated in 1842, so over 172 years ago on July 4th in that year. The sort of, you know, best known story is that in 1840 there was a riot on the lawn. In the UVA's early years, the students were very rebellious and very quick to, you know, riot and cause trouble. So how the story goes is that in 1840 there was a riot on the lawn, and a popular professor of American law who was living in Pavilion Number 10, John Davis, stepped outside his pavilion to quell the disturbance, and was shot dead by a masked student. And the story goes that the students were horrified by this, and decided to come together and you know, find the perpetrator, and that this was sort of the first instance of students coming together to enforce you know, some degree of honor in the community. And then 2 years later, the code was officially introduced. Now that's that happened. The John Davis incident actually happened, but the more that we look into it, the more we realize that there's probably not actually a connection between John Davis's death and the founding of the honor system.
So the origin is a little fictionalized.
It's a little murky. Yes. Where there is a connection is that John Davis's replacement in the faculty was a professor named Henry St. George Tucker, who was a professor of law. And 2 years later, in 1842, he was teaching his class and was horrified by the amount of cheating that he saw going on in his classroom. And so he decided at a meeting of the general faculty, he introduced a resolution saying that he wanted students to begin affixing the honor code at the end of all of their examinations.
Tell me again, how long, when did the honor code come into existence?
So this is, he made this resolution on July 4th in 1842. And so that's you know, sort of the formal founding of the honor system. And so it was, so at first it was actually created by the faculty, and the code itself was borrowed from a similar one that Henry St. George Tucker had seen at William and Mary. He was familiar with this this notion already. The so in its early days, you know, the faculty administered it. Although pretty soon students realized that they you know, they didn't really like it that faculty members were, you know, breathing over their shoulders trying to make sure that they were, you know, living up to this pledge that they were making at the end of all their work.
So those gosh darn adults.
Yeah. So the students quickly decided that they wanted to take responsibility. They wanted to take the honor, this honor code, this honor system into their own hands. And so students began to administer the system. So in its early days, the honor, it was very sort of nebulous and undefined. Students could be expelled for doing just about anything. I mean, there are records of students being asked to leave UVA for cheating at cards, for making girls cry, you know, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, obviously the system has changed a lot since then. But two things, there are two things that haven't changed since the honor code's founding. One is that it's completely student run. It's a lot more structured now than it used to be back then. Students would just sort of get together in groups, find, you know, approach someone who they think had committed an honor offense and tell them that they had 24 hours to skip town. Doesn't quite work like that anymore, although it is still completely student run. And then the other thing that has remained a part of the system is the single sanction. And the single sanction is just says that any student who's found guilty of committing an honor offense, the only punishment for that is expulsion.
Our guest today, Nick Hahn, he's the chair of UVA's Honor Committee. We're going to be talking about the Honor Code, recent changes. Nick mentioned single sanction, and there have been some alterations in just the last year or 2 years.
2 years, yeah.
For a program that's been in existence for over 170 years. This is WNRN, as well as Crozet in the Valley's 101.1. Thank you for being here with us today. So, Nick, the program, the Honor Code, has been in existence for over 170 years. So let's go to the last, let's see if you can do 30.
Sure.
Without specific numbers. But has the number of reported cases increased, decreased, remain the same? Do you know?
So can't speak too much for the last 30 years, but at least in the last 10 or 15, we're pretty sure that the number of reports per year has decreased.
Is that because there is more honor at the university among students, or is that one of the issues that has been brought up, is that there's less faith in the system, and so there are fewer reports?
You know, I hope it's because there's more honor, but we think that it is likely due to the fact that we have a fairly low reporting rate.
Can anybody make a report?
Anyone can make a report. So students, faculty, staff, Charlottesville residents, anyone at all can make a report. Yeah.
Actually, let's do this: lying, cheating, and stealing. Again, Nick Hine, mm-hmm. he's the chair at UVA's honor committee. As we're starting off talking about the honor code at the university, which has more than 170 years since its beginning, and in the last 2 years has finally had some significant changes made to it. Define cheating, because I think is cheating, the definition of cheating at the honor code, as simple as the average person might think, or, you know, is it a little more malleable than we might think?
You know, it's a little more nuanced, I think, than most people might assume. So, it obviously primarily covers the academic realm, there's a little more to it than just looking at someone's paper when you're taking a test. There are four different types of cheating that are explicitly defined. Falsifying data, and, you know, for example, in a lab report or something, to try to get better results, false citation, and then multiple submission. Multiple submission being that you submit for credit an assignment that you'd previously submitted for credit in another class.
So the work I did for my religious studies class can't also be submitted for my political theory class?
Well, if it's applicable, maybe. What I always tell students is that it can't hurt to ask. You want to ask your professor. Some professors will say, you know, yeah, if you did an assignment for this other class that actually works quite well for this class, you know, maybe make a couple changes to it, submit it, totally fine. If you go ahead and do that without asking, some professors will see that as, you know, you're misrepresenting your work. And not actually doing any work, and so it can be in some cases considered cheating, and so that's the other reason why the cheating definition is a little bit nuanced, because to some extent it depends a lot on a professor's requirements in his classroom. I mean, I've had just in my experience some professors who are huge sticklers for citation guidelines and really, really want very thorough citations, bibliography, the whole nine yards. And then I've had other professors who say, you know, it doesn't really matter. At the end, tell me, you know, which books you used but in-text citation, don't really bother. And so, for that class, you miss a citation or something, probably isn't a big deal. If you miss a citation in the other class, maybe a bigger deal. You know, the professor, basically what I'm trying to say is that professors oftentimes have different standards when it comes to, citation guidelines and that sort of stuff in their classroom.
Well, you talk about the definitions of cheating, and we already mentioned that the number of cases reported has decreased. Do you notice any unusual statistics between gender or ethnicity or race from the numbers that are at the university itself for the number of cases that are reported for specific categories and groups?
Yeah, so we don't keep statistics about, demographics regarding students who are reported. What I can say is that something that the Honor Committee has been concerned with really the last three decades is this issue of disproportionate reporting. And so the issue being that we see some groups of students are overrepresented in the pool of students who are reported and are reported at a higher rate than they should be given their representation in the student body. And so we see that now these days primarily for athletes and for international students, or so the two groups that we see reported at a higher rate than one would assume that they should be.
And make sure I understand that properly, is that someone is accusing an international student or an athlete of cheating more than at a higher rate than someone is reporting other members of the university student base?
Not necessarily at a higher rate as other students, but at a higher rate than you know, they should be, given that these groups of students make up a fairly, you know, low percentage of the overall student population.
Our guest, Nick Hine from University of Virginia, he's the chair of UVA's Honor Committee.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
T&N Printing, serving Virginia since 1982. In addition to printing and copying, T&N specializes in construction document management, as well as dry mounting, binding, and mail services. T&N offers FSC-certified printing. T&N Printing can be reached at t-nprinting.com.
Fardowners, local beer, local food, local music, and local vibe at the Square in Crozet. Fardowners hosts trivia on Monday night, sponsored by Star Hill Brewery. There's live music every weekend. You can find the schedule at fardowners.com.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being with us today, talking with Nick Hine. He's the chair at UVA's Honor Committee. We're talking about the Honor Code, some of the recent changes that have been made to it, how the system works, and then how it flows into the rest of the world. Now, Nick, I found this from a 2013 newsletter put out by the Honor Committee, and it says, "All is not well with the honor system. For more than 170 years, ours has been one of the most famously effective honor codes in the nation, and yet today, fewer than 5% of the student-observed honor offenses are reported. These reports that are filed are demographically disproportionate. Juries' verdicts are often tremendously inconsistent, and some faculty have abandoned the system altogether. The honor system belongs to us. We are its stewards. It is time that we address these problems together." Now, this came from the honor system committee itself.
Yes, it did.
Saying that all is not well. Now, this led to, or did this come after, some changes that were made, and let's talk about those changes.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the changes. So, what happened? So this is the biggest change to the system in you know, a decade or two happened 2 years ago, and it was ratified by a student-wide referendum. And so, the change is called the informed retraction, or the IR. And so, what the informed retraction is. It's an avenue for forgiveness within the system. The informed retraction, basically, what happens is if a student is reported for an honor offense, they have 7 days in which to decide whether or not to declare guilt and file an informed retraction. So the informed retraction is predicated on a student's integrity, and it's a way for students who are, you know, possess the proper integrity to come forward and admit to committing an honor offense. It's a way for them to remain within the community ultimately after taking a 2-semester leave of absence from UVA. And so it's sort of a logical extension of this an aspect of the system that we've had for some time, which is called the conscientious retraction, or the CR. And so what the CR is that if a student commits an honor offense and then you know, immediately regrets it, immediately feels very guilty, they can come forward to someone in the honor committee and say, you know, I cheated on this test. I feel really bad, and you know, I want to make it right. And so, if a student does that, they can, basically declare that they've committed an honor offense. Go to all affected parties to make amends. And so, in this case, it would be, you know, the professor of the class say, you know, I'm sorry, I cheated on this test. I feel really bad. Would like to make it right. They have to accept all potential consequences from that, insofar as they're making amends. So you know, if the professor might fail him on the test or something. But then by submitting this conscientious retraction, they're exonerated from all potential honor charges that, that might come up.
So the conscientious retraction is I did something and I feel bad about it. Before anybody else finds out, mm-hmm. I'm going to say I'm sorry and accept a... How long is the punishment? I mean, you have to repay or, you know, accept the F in the class or whatever happens. And then what sort of punishment is there by the university?
So there's no punishment besides that. So
I just take an F in the class. We'll make it nice and simple. Mm-hmm. I cheat on my economics exam. Before anybody else knows, I say, God, I shouldn't have done that. Professor, I cheated. Honor committee, I cheated. Whatever happens, I'm either told to retake it or I take my F. And then, but that's it.
That's it. The idea being that if you have the proper integrity to come forward before, and the important thing is that you come forward before you have reason to believe that anyone suspects you of committing this honor offense. You know, if you possess the proper integrity to do that, you deserve to keep your place in our community.
Is there a time frame? I mean, if I cheated on that test in the spring, and it's been bugging me forever, and in the fall, I finally admit to it, but I was never, you know, no one ever said anything about it. The professor and the teaching assistant never questioned my grade.
Yeah, so there's no official time frame. Again, the important thing is just that you file it in good faith, which means that you file it before you have reason to believe that anyone suspects you of committing said offense.
And then how long is that? How long has the conscientious issue retraction been around?
So that's been, I think it's been around since the 70s. I don't know the exact year, maybe 73. So that's been a part of the system for quite some time. Okay. And the informed retraction is really just an outgrowth of that. So, so it involves, it's really the same procedure where you come forward and you say, you know, I've committed this honor offense. You go to the all affected parties to make amends, but then, you know, since it is not it's different from the conscientious retraction in that, you know, you're coming forward only after you've been reported for an honor offense. So what happens then is that you'll finish out your semester and then take a 2-semester leave of absence, a full fall and spring or spring and fall, after which time you're allowed to reenter the community of trust. As a normal student, and one last thing is that the other major difference between the two is that you can file as many CRs as you want. You can file as many conscientious retractions as you'd like in your time as a UVA student. You could file one every day if you wanted. However, you only get one informed retraction. You can only file an informed retraction for one honor offense.
And you have to take your punishment on that within a week. Is that correct?
You only have to make the decision within a week. You have a 7-day period within which to decide whether or not to take an informed retraction. The actual leave of absence doesn't begin until you finish your current semester.
We are talking about UVA's honor system and honor itself with our guest today, University of Virginia's chair, the Honor Committee, Nick Hine. If you have a question about this, I don't know if you went to UVA and you had questions about the honor code and its functionality. If you maybe went to another school, maybe you just live in the area and you have questions of faith or disbelief. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919. Nick, in that piece that I read before we started this part of the discussion, came from a 2013 newsletter from the Honor Committee, and it said fewer than 5% of student-observed honor offenses are reported. How do we know that number?
So that number comes from a 2012 survey. It was a survey that surveyed a representative population of UVA students, and one of the big takeaways from that was out of all of the students who said that they had, or they thought they had, observed a potential honor offense, only 5% of those students in the next question said that they had actually reported that offense to the Honor Committee.
Now, you know, in preparing for today's show and looking through other schools' honor codes, there are, especially for some of our military service schools, Military Academy at the Army, not reporting an honor offense is itself its own honor offense. At the Navy, the person witnessing the honor violation can personally confront that individual and without reporting it, and see if that person will, on their own, report their conscientious retraction, sort of thing. How does that work if you have 95% of the people witnessing an honor offense and not reporting it? So if you're at the Army, that's a whole large number of people who are committing their own honor offense. But at the University of Virginia, that's not an issue.
Yeah, I mean, we really do have an accountability problem, I think. At West Point, we not reporting an honor offense is not in itself an honor offense. It used to be, actually, in our system. There used to be what's called the non-toleration clause, and so students would pledge not to lie, cheat, or steal, nor to tolerate those who do. And so, just like at West Point, a student who saw an honor offense and didn't report it was, him or herself, guilty of committing an honor offense. And so the student body came together and actually decided that they didn't like this very much, took it out of the system, and so there's no longer, a formal mechanism to hold students accountable. Many people, I think, see this as one of the biggest mistakes in the history of the honor system. You know, it certainly does hurt the student accountability. It almost certainly contributes to the, not having this, certainly contributes to the low reporting rate. But then again, when students come to me and say, I think I saw something, I really don't know what to report it. It's tough. I'm not always going to tell them that I think that they should report it. When you see an honor offense or a potential honor offense, the decision to report is a tough one. It's a highly personal one because, for the reporter, it requires a large commitment both of time and also, an emotional commitment as well. These proceedings are not easy to go through from either side. When you're making that decision, you really have to weigh values of loyalty, particularly if it's someone that you know or someone you're friends with, against those of, honor and integrity. And trust, and so it's tough, and oftentimes students will come to me and say, I really don't feel comfortable reporting this person. They're a good friend of mine. They're my roommate. I don't want to ruin our relationship, and I don't want them to get kicked out of school. And so, in cases like that, I think it's important to do, to do something like what they do at Navy, just to do anything to confront them in some form, and go up to them and say, I'm not going to report you for this, but I really feel uncomfortable with what you did. I really think that what you did was wrong. It doesn't have any place in this community. You should make amends somehow, even if you're not going through the formal process. And I think that is actually what happens a lot of the times. I think that students who are uncomfortable reporting oftentimes do at least do something about it. And we don't have any formal statistics on that, but just sort of based off of anecdotal encounters with these sorts of situations, I think that students, are willing to hold each other accountable, just not necessarily through the formal mechanisms of the honor system.
434-979-0919 if you have a question or a comment about the topic today. We're talking about the honor code and honor itself, philosophies, processes, and criticisms of honor at UVA. By the way, Nick, I copied that from somewhere, but I can't remember where. On my honor, I pledge that I have neither given nor received help on this assignment, which is the current academic honor code statement at the university. Nick, so you talk about, we're talking about the conscientious retraction, the informed retraction. For a long time, there was just a single sanction punishment. mm-hmm. where it was you cheat, you get caught, and you're expelled. And that because the argument of bringing about something like the conscientious retraction or the informed retraction has been a discussion for decades and decades. And until we got the changes in the system, calls for change were always voted down. What is the discussion? What is the good reasoning for having just a single sanction?
So the single sanction, and I guess I'll start this off by saying, you know, there is still a single sanction, even, you know, despite the fact that we have this informed retraction, this avenue for forgiveness, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not still a single sanction. Any student who goes to trial and is found guilty of committing an honor offense will still be asked to leave the university. And so I think the conversation surrounding the single sanction and the informed retraction, they're different conversations. And the single sanction has come up a number of times. It comes up maybe every 4 or 5 years for a vote, and every time it's been upheld by a referendum of the student body. And I think the reason for that is students. I think the student body has always appreciated the single sanction as a symbol for our commitment to the ideals and the values of honor. It represents our esteem for honor. It's impossible to say that, you know, you look at UVA, it's impossible to say, oh, you know, they don't take it very seriously when, you know, we have something like the single sanction. And so I think it works very well as a symbol. I think it works as a disapprobation of honor offenses. You know, we have at UVA lower rates of cheating, far lower rates of cheating than at, you know, the average American university. And then I think that those all, you know, sort of contributing come together to you know, really help form this community of trust, this thing that you know, I see as sort of the biggest end, the end goal of the system, which is to form foster a culture of integrity. I think the single sanction is a very important part of that culture.
You mentioned that university has a much lower percentage of cheating than at your average school. Are you basing that on the polls that were taken several years ago, that gave you the 5% rate of people who report it?
Yeah, so the 2012 student survey, in that survey, 5% of students, and this is an anonymous confidential survey, but 5% of students admitted to having committed an honor offense in their time at the university. And it's something like 12% of students said that they maybe did, they just weren't really sure. So even if we take that at its highest number, even if we assume that all 12% of those students who think they might have committed an honor offense actually committed an honor offense, you know, that's 17%, maybe it's 20%, even, because, you know, even though it's a confidential survey, not everyone's gonna want to admit that. If you compare that to their survey, there are many surveys out there, a lot of them through the International Center for Academic Integrity, and those surveys will pin, you know, rates of cheating at other schools anywhere from, you know, 75% to 90%, depending on how cheating is defined. And so even if you think that, you know, the UVA number is a little low, there is still, you know, or it's still orders of magnitude lower than this number that we see at other schools. And you know, that's pretty incredible.
11:34 here on the Wake Up Call, talking with Nick Hine. He's the chair at UVA's Honor Committee, as we talk about university's honor code and some somewhat recent changes that have been made to it. Nick, do you think that students that attend schools with strict honor codes just make more ethical people in the real world?
You know, I think there's some reason to believe that. I think that, you know, at UVA, going through UVA, you know, the UVA honor system, if nothing else, it makes you care about things like integrity and honesty. You know, you sort of learn the types of lessons that you're not going to learn at a school where cheating is rampant. I mean, there are schools, and I've talked to professors about this who have experienced teaching at other top universities in the country, who say that at a lot of places cheating is like a game. It's a game for the students, and you know, they give each other credit for whoever is best at outwitting their professors and trying, and that's how they get ahead. At UVA, it's not like that. At UVA, people do their work, they do it honestly, and they care about things like integrity and moral courage and truth. And I think that sets you up really well for when you go off into the real world. And talking to alumni, of the university, a lot of them at least will be the first to tell you that the honor system is one of the most important things that they took away from UVA. I think it really colors your future interactions outside of UVA. And people say, if it wasn't for the honor system, I don't know, what I'd be doing. It has taught me how to be honest and truthful in all of my daily dealings. It has helped me in my career. It has taught me to always do the right thing, even if it's not the easy thing. And I think that, one of the things that distinguishes a UVA degree from a lot of degrees is, anyone who sees it knows that you earned it yourself, and that it means something. And B, I think that, one can reasonably expect UVA alums, to understand and respect the ideals of honor.
But it's not just the University of Virginia. I mean, I think for those of us here in the area, for those of us who maybe in the region, whether or not our community listeners who didn't attend the university, there are plenty of other schools. In fact, go to our 100% correct Wikipedia page, and you can find all sorts of schools listed that have a significantly usable, punishable honor code. Mm-hmm. And they would put out a lot of people into this nation. And so I question whether or not the honor code goes with you after you're 4 or 5 or 7 years here at the university.
Well, I'm not saying that it's going to go, per se with everyone. I mean, we do have this problem, as we were talking about, with student disengagement from the system. The students who go through UVA and don't really buy into the system, of which there are plenty of those students, I likely won't have a change of heart after they graduate. I think for a lot of students, for those who really care about it in their time at the university, I think it's something that does go with you. Clearly not every, there are 23,000 students at the university, and it is hard to reach every single one of them. But I think that, I think that we do a fairly good job of reaching those who we can, and I think just sort of anecdotally, I'd push back a little bit because I think that of a lot of the alums that I've talked to, the first thing that most of them ask about is before they even know that I'm involved in honors, how's the honor system doing?
I do think it's a major part of the conversation on grounds, and it was during my time there as well. Now that I've been out of school for a noticeable amount of time, sometimes question, and I see that the same phrase is being written today as it was when I was in school, and you have to write it every time. On my honor, I pledge that I have neither given nor received help on this assignment, but at some point, it's just another sentence. It shouldn't be, and I hope that it's not, and you probably hope even at a greater standard than I do that it's not. But as I think as the ethics of our world have changed, I wonder if the meaning of that sentence has changed to a few too many people. Nick Hine here on the show with us today is the chair of UVA's Honor Committee as we talk about UVA's Honor Code and what's going on grounds and how that may play out into the real world. Be right back.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
Telegraph Gallery Art and Comics at 110 4th Street on Charlottesville's Downtown Mall and TelegraphGallery.com. Dealing screen-printed art and independently published comics and zines by local and national artists. You can find Telegraph Gallery in downtown Charlottesville and at TelegraphGallery.com.
McGrady's Irish Pub on Grady Avenue, a veteran-owned sports pub under new ownership and management. McGrady's new menu holds a variety of loaded baked potatoes and Blarney Stone steaks. McGrady's supports local charities, hosts trivia on Tuesdays and ladies' night on Wednesdays, and is dedicated to getting everyone a safe ride home. McGrady'sIrishPub.com.
Family-owned Carter Mountain Orchard and Vineyard, inviting you to pick your own apple this fall. With dozens of apple varieties available, the orchard staff can help you pick the right apple for your baking or snacking needs. Online at CarterMountainOrchard.com.
Hi, I'm Joe Caputi from the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank. There's more than enough food in America for every man, woman, and child. Yet here in the Charlottesville area, more than 33,000 people face hunger. The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank serves 22 million meals each year and provides them to people in need through food pantries, shelters, soup kitchens, schools, and other feeding programs. You can join us in providing nourishment, relief, and hope to our neighbors in need by sharing a small gift, a bag of groceries, a few hours of your time, or just $1 donation makes a difference. For every dollar you give, we can provide 4 meals to families in need. Also, Blue Ridge Area Food Bank is accepting monetary donations at Misty Mountain Music Festival. For more information, brafb.org. I'm Joe Caputi, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you for being with us today. Beautiful Sunday out there. By the way, next week is Fun Drive Sunday here at WNRN. I think we start this coming Friday and go for 8 days. And thanks to previous Fun Drives and their success, continue to trim the number of days that the Fun Drive is needed. Next Sunday, I'll have my nephew here with me once again, starting sixth grade, first year in middle school, as we interview a middle school principal about bullying. Seems like a good text there for the middle schooler to talk to the middle school principal about bullying. But today, Nick Hine with us, chair at UVA's Honor Committee, as we talk about honor and specifically UVA's honor code, but honor in general. Nick, we always hear the discussion about the faculty's failing faith in the honor code and its success. Has that changed any? And you know, what is the faculty's role in making the honor code successful?
You know, this is a conversation that we have often, really all the time. It's something that we've been seeing since 70s, 80s. There's always this discussion about, the faculty reluctance to use the system. I think recently we see that a lot of this stems from two different things. I guess we can talk about three things. So the three biggest concerns that we've been hearing in the last couple of years from faculty members are, the lack of forgiveness in the system, the long and sort of arduous process that it takes to go, from filing a report to, the eventual verdict at trial. And then the third thing being the inconsistency of verdicts at trial rendered by student juries. This concern that faculty members will often come with a report that they think is a total slam dunk, think it should be, easy process, all the way to trial to reach a guilty verdict, and then a random student panel will turn back a not guilty verdict, and a lot of professors are concerned about that. And so those are the three top concerns that we see. I think those are the three top concerns. I think that might be the order that we tend to see them in. The first concern, the lack of forgiveness has been mostly mitigated, I think, by the informed retraction. And I will say that the informed retraction, this change that was implemented 2 years ago, has you know, been overwhelmingly supported by the faculty. So that leaves the other two, the sort of long, arduous process, which to some extent, you know, we have little control over. You know, the system is not quite as simple as it used to be, where you know, you could go up to you'd go up to your fellow students, say you have 24 hours to either request a trial or leave, and everyone would just leave anyway. You know, now we have a number of, you know, sort of systematic reasons why, you know, methods that actually, you know, sort of increase the length of time that we need, that we need to investigate and process a case.
No difference from, you know, the judicial system in elsewhere in the United States.
Yeah, because it all goes back to the fact that, you know, we need to provide students with their due process rights. And so that, and you know, part of that means giving notice, you know, effective notice being that, you know, you have to have a certain number of days to process everything. You know, you have to have enough time to prepare for your trial. You can't really just say, we can no longer say you have 24 hours, either request a trial or leave, because that's, you know, it's not against the student's rights. So that's, you know, that's really where the big issue of, you know, this long time, we have taken steps to make the process, you know, as efficient as we can. But there is sort of a, you know, there's a pretty strong barrier at a certain point that prevents us from making the process, the investigation and trial process any shorter than it actually is. And so then the third concern that faculty members often have is inconsistent jury verdicts. And so, you know, a lot of this comes from the fact that a guilty verdict is quite hard to reach. We have a standard of proof that is beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that's the highest standard of proof there is, you know, sort of the 97 to 99% standard of proof. And so because of that, a lot of cases that, you know, make it all the way to trial, which, you know, in which clearly something happened, you know, there's obviously some wrongdoing, some sort of honor violation. But there's simply not enough evidence for the jury to turn back a guilty verdict. You know, those cases are often very frustrating for everyone involved. And then, you know, we think that at least some of the cases that go before a random student jury that, you know, should or would meet the burden of proof, are being nullified by, some members of the jury who, you know, despite professing support for the single sanction, when they, you know, are sitting on that panel and, you know, are looking at one of their peers and hearing them tell their story, you know, at the end of all of that are simply unwilling to vote guilty and apply the single sanction. And so it's, you know, so we see an issue of both sort of fairness between trials, but also an issue of faculty members who, after devoting months of their time and all of this energy to, you know, seeing this process through, are disappointed when it all comes for naught at the end. And so a lot of those professors are then, you know, unwilling to bring another case to the honor system. They would rather save their time and deal with it, you know, in their classroom, deal with it on their own. And so, you know, and this perpetuates a little bit because, you know, obviously not every professor goes through this process and sees it, but the ones that who do, I think, you know, are often telling particularly new professors, you know, about their experiences, because all new professors, when they see these things, you know, when they are learning about the honor code, they'll ask the more experienced faculty in their department, say, you know, what's your experience with it, all this, and if they're hearing, you know, oh, my experience was bad, you know, I'm never going to report again, it's highly unlikely that these new professors are also going to bring, are then, you know, going to turn around and bring a report in front of the committee. And so it sort of perpetuates itself. It's very frustrating. But again, it's really not a new problem. It's something that we've been struggling with for quite some time.
Again, our guest, Nick Hine, he's from UVA's Honor Committee. We're talking about the Honor Code, some recent changes in the last couple years, as well as honor in general outside of the university. So, Nick, we talk about the honor code specifically mentions you make a commitment to not lie, cheat, or steal.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that, and it's meant to be for when you're on grounds, for when you're at any time you're representing yourself as a University of Virginia student.
That's correct.
One of the issues that often comes up, especially from my time spent working on the corner, is, hey, what about fake IDs? Where does that stand? Underage drinking.
Well, so first of all, underage drinking and fake IDs are you know, a violation of the law, and so would clearly fall under the University Judiciary Committee. And so UJC is a separate, fully student-run adjudicatory body, disciplinary body, but UJC handles violations of the UVA Code of Conduct or Standards of Conduct, which include things like, you know, using false identification, underage drinking, any violation of local or state law, those kinds of things. And so they handle a much broader range of issues than honor does. I mean, we only do lying, cheating, and stealing, and UJC effectively does everything else.
But many would say that lying, I mean, having a fake ID to get a drink is, in fact, I mean, that's lying, correct?
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, all that said, all the UJC things said, you know, using a fake ID, misrepresenting your age, could potentially be an honor offense. I mean, the honor committee isn't in the habit of making policy declarations. And, you know, I would never say that anything that involves misrepresenting something is, you know, explicitly not an honor offense. If someone, you know, came forward and reported another student for using a fake ID, we would go ahead and process the case, as if it were any other report. The thing is that we just don't get these reports. We don't see students being reported for using a fake ID. And I think the reason behind that is, one of the standards of an honor offense, one of the, things that needs to be fulfilled for an honor offense to be an honor offense is it needs to be significant. And so significance is this community standard, and is one of the three things that has to be proven at trial that open toleration of said honor offense, would be inconsistent with the community of trust. And so I think that, when a lot of students think about this issue, think about, using fake ID, especially consider what a random student jury would probably think if this issue went to trial. You know, a lot of students, I think, are going to see the widespread use of fake IDs as a sort of, frankly, they're everywhere.
It's tolerable within our community.
Yeah, I mean, because if you think about how common it is, I think a lot of students are going to think, you know, since so many people have them, open toleration of their use is not inconsistent with our community of trust. I think significance is sort of where this issue falls. And I'm not saying that that's, always going to be the answer that a jury might come up with. It's impossible to say what would happen if we actually got one of these things. But I think that a lot of students, when sort of evaluating, whether or not an issue like using a fake ID or misrepresenting your age is in fact an honor offense, they're going to look to significance and say, it happens so often, it can't be significant.
Well, one of the reasons I asked that question, certainly from having spent a lot of years having to ID people, also comes from, you can, for those who are interested, you can go to the UVA site, find the Honor Committee, and then there's a section where you can look up public summaries. So sort of the last semester's they're listed anonymously, of course, but some of the information on what happened. And so under the conscientious retractions, someone filed a suit for telling a lie during a job interview. Someone else filed their conscientious retraction for stealing a street sign. And somebody else lied to a professor in order to skip class. And so, I'm just trying to figure out where the fake ID falls into those things. If somebody, or do you think that those would have been questionable in terms of their significance, that being a key part of the jury trial, I mean, you know, is this because it's conscientious retraction? Is that why it stands out in my mind? Because I'm surprised that somebody would own up for telling a lie during an interview or stealing a street sign to use as a wall fixture in their home, in their apartment.
You know, it's tough to say. It's tough to compare potential honor offenses against each other and, you know, get into the business of saying, you know, which is more significant, which is worse, that kind of thing. You know, as far as conscientious retractions go, I mean, significance is not one of the things that is evaluated when a student comes forward. So a student could come forward and say, and file a CR, say, I used my fake ID at Boylan the other night. I feel really bad and I'm sorry. And we'd accept it, you know, and we'd publish it in our newsletter. Though I will say that some of those, you know, some of these things that we see coming, you know, these conscientious retractions, you know, oftentimes are for the types of offenses that we see go all the way to trial and, you know, have in the past resulted in guilty verdicts.
And a reminder that the conscientious retraction only does not have expulsion as a punishment, correct?
That's correct.
As you mentioned earlier, the conscientious retraction is just related to anything involving that. So lying to an interviewer, assuming that the business that's interviewing you is off grounds, you're not going to suffer an F in your class. Stealing a street sign may get you a fine from the city, but is not going to lower your GPA.
Yeah, but
am I understanding that properly?
You are, but I think the beauty of that is that, you know, students who, you know, the students in question are, you know, possess the proper integrity to come forward, even though, you know, it's not going to affect their GPA or something. You know, they're coming forward because, you know, they think because it's the right thing to do. And I think, you know, the conscientious retraction is such a good part of our system. It's such a strength because it, you know, is predicated solely on a student's integrity. You know, there's no, it's all about just, you know, whether or not you have the courage to come forward. And that's why those students, you know, we think should be allowed to remain at UVA.
11:57 here on the Wake Up Call. Just a few minutes left with Nick Hine. He's our guest today, chair of UVA's Honor Committee. So, Nick, where do you see, so now the university still has its single sanction punishment of being expelled if you go all the way through the trial system. There's a conscientious retraction that we've talked about several times in terms of stepping up and doing the right thing for any crime or negative act that's been committed. And then there's the informed retraction, which is when somebody says, by the way, we think we saw you committing where you've broken the honor code.
An honor offense.
An honor offense, thank you, and can, you know, step aside for two semesters. Is there another step in the process that you think or the honor committee discusses as the next tweak in the system to make it better?
Yeah, so it's tough to say exactly what might be coming in, you know, through the pipeline. I will say that no matter what, we should expect there, you know, continued progress in the honor system. I think, you know, starting from 2 years ago when the informed retraction was implemented, there's been a very concerted effort to critically analyze the system. You know, look at the things that we could be doing better, and, you know, have very open discussions about the drawbacks of the system, about the ways in which honor can be improved. You know, that's why we, you know, are having very open discussions now about things like faculty resistance, you know, student ambivalence towards the system, low reporting rates, disproportionate reporting. I mean, these are not the sort of conversations that I think were very common in years past. But you know, today we are very open about, you know, saying that these are the issues, these are the reasons, you know, these are things that we need to work on, and we need everyone's help. You know, we've done a lot of reaching out to the student body and soliciting opinions and stuff like that. Because, you know, the honor system doesn't belong solely to the 27 students on the honor committee. I mean, there's 23,000 plus students at UVA who are all stewards of the system. But I think moving forward, we're going to, like, more specifically, we're going to look at improving some of the internal procedures of the committee. Just, you know, I think trying to make sure that, you know, our own shop is in order. And then I think we're going to prioritize tackling this issue of disproportionate reporting. We've commissioned a study through a class of PhD candidates in the Curry School of Education, and they're going to do a little work to try to figure out, you know, exactly where this is coming from, why it happens, and that way we can hopefully, you know, do a little bit of work to try to mitigate some of the reasons behind it.
Nick Hine here, chairman of UVA's Honor Committee. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about the positives, but also discussing some of the negatives or the constructive criticism that I think you and I both find an important cause at the Honor Code.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Rick.
Next week is Fun Drive Sunday. Listen in, make your pledge, and listen to a sixth grader talk to a principal of a middle school about bullying.
This has been your Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong and Max Cecilia Struther. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.